Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science.
Today, we're bringing you a special episode of Life's Little Mysteries. Usually, we keep things pretty light, but this time, we're going to focus on a serious topic that everybody is talking about, and that's the SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes the disease COVID-19.
At Life Science, our reporters and our editors are tracking the latest coronavirus developments around the world, from global case numbers and quarantines to vaccine development to best practices for safety, prevention, and treatment.
Here with the latest coronavirus news is Life Science health reporter Nicoletta Lanice. She's at the forefront of our coronavirus coverage.
This episode was recorded on April 2nd and features Nicoletta's weekly coronavirus update and Q&A on Facebook Live. Link to the video is in the show notes.
Hello, and welcome to this week's coronavirus update with Life Science. My name is Nicoletta Lanice, and I'm a health reporter here at the site, and I'm here to answer your questions about COVID-19, its symptoms, give you updates on treatments, vaccines, everything you can think of. We hold this live stream for about half an hour every Thursday, so we try to get to as many questions as possible, but I'm going to start off with a brief recap from the past week in terms of scientific developments, where we're at with case numbers, etc., and then I'll open up the floor to your comments. So these numbers have updated several times even today. So as of this moment, the total case count worldwide is more than 962,000 confirmed cases of the coronavirus. To be absolutely crystal clear, confirmed cases is distinct from the number of actual cases in that because diagnostic testing worldwide is not ubiquitous, not everyone who has COVID-19 can or will receive a test right now, the actual number of cases is likely higher than this number. We do not know by how much. About 49,000 people have died from the disease so far, more than 49,000 worldwide, and about 203,000 have recovered after receiving a formal diagnosis of COVID-19. Within mainland China, we're seeing that there are now more than 82,400 reported cases. This is just up from 81,000 roughly, or 81,700 last week when I gave you this update. Just given the difference between those two numbers, we can see that the rate of new infection has dropped off significantly from what we saw at the very beginning of the outbreak, particularly. Here within the U.S., we are now seeing that there are more than 216,000 confirmed cases, up from about 69,000 last week. So again, this is a reflection both of diagnostic testing ramping up, new tests coming out, being distributed by private labs, as well as the CDC, being able to be verified at clinics rather than sent off to the CDC as they did at the very beginning and sent back afterwards. So as we see diagnostic testing become even more ubiquitous through time, that number is just going to keep going up for now. And again, we don't know what the true case count in the U.S. is. The number of deaths in the U.S. so far from this virus are over 5,100 so far. Some of these include infants in a number of states. So I just want to highlight that this truly is a disease that can affect all demographics. There are people in higher risk categories for potentially developing very serious complications, but these serious complications have been seen in people of all age groups, people of all health status. So just to keep that in mind, in and when social distancing measures come down in your particular location, that's kind of the context we're working in, is that everyone is vulnerable, so we all have to work together to try to mitigate spread. Within the U.S., there have been reported over 8,700 cases of recovered patients. So these patients have recovered after receiving a formal diagnosis again. So last week, that number was far lower. So it seems that that also reflects a higher rate of detection and diagnostics and tracking people who have been hospitalized, et cetera. So we're seeing more clarity in the U.S. numbers than we've seen in the past. It's still not nearly where we need it to be to truly know where we're at now and where we need to be in, say, a month's time. but it's nice that those numbers are indeed trending more towards what's probably more realistic. Just general updates from the U.S. this week. We see that President Trump has extended his social distancing guidelines from the federal government until at least April 30th. These are fairly common sense guidelines in terms of social distancing practices and identifying those in groups who should be even more careful in instituting these measures in their own lives. So the elderly above, say, 60, 65, and anyone who's immunocompromised in any way or has some sort of prior lung condition in particular or heart condition would fall into these categories. We've seen that the Olympics has officially been postponed after quite a long time of that postponement being put off. So that's official now. And here in New York, the U.S. Navy ship USNS Comfort has now docked in the city, and that supplies an additional 1,000 hospital beds, which will be used for patients who do not have COVID-19. So to give overflow to hospitals that need space for patients who are coming in for other things is what that ship is here to do. But we're also seeing throughout the country many field hospitals being set up. There's one in Central Park now. Many overflow beds are being established ahead of time so that as we anticipate the case count will grow and hospitals will need to send people to different places to take care of them. The entire U.S. is ramping up for that at this moment. We have gotten further reports about domestic pets catching COVID-19. So there was a report, a small case study out of China that found that both cats and ferrets are susceptible to catching COVID-19. But it's unlikely, generally speaking, that dogs, chickens, pigs, or ducks can catch it. So there has been instances where dogs have had confirmed cases of the virus, but they do not show overt symptoms, and they don't seem to become ill, in other words. And there's no evidence that dogs can pass it back to people. With cats, it would seem, at least in a small lab experiment where 5 cats were given a high dose of the virus, the cats can become physically ill in a noticeable way, in a measurable way, in a similar way to humans, and pass that infection on to other cats via respiratory droplets, which is the same way the virus transmits between people. There's no evidence that cats can pass the virus to humans at this point. So it seems like if your cat were to pick up an infection from you, for instance, and you have another cat, it could pass it to another cat. But again, this was a fairly small study, so just take that with a grain of salt. But in that, this is the first one that has really formally looked at how the illness looks in cats in a laboratory setting. There is some evidence that cats can both fall ill from the coronavirus and potentially pass it to other cats. We also saw this week an account of a woman who developed a fairly rare brain condition who was also diagnosed with COVID-19. So this brain condition is known as acute necrotizing encephalopathy, which is in essence where there's an acute injury in the brain that causes brain cells to die off. And there's often swelling and there's an altered mental state that arises from this damage. So the woman in this case presented with confusion, disorientation, in addition to kind of some of the telltale signs of COVID-19, which include fever and a cough. So she came into the hospital after having this altered mental state and having had this fever and cough for about 3 days. She tested positive for COVID-19 after being tested for both bacterial and other viral infections, tested negative for all the ones they looked at, but tested positive for COVID-19. They gave her both a CT and an MRI scan to assess structural damage in the brain and found evidence of hemorrhage, meaning that there was ruptured blood vessels in the organ, leading to signs of caked blood and et cetera in the organ. So she remains in hospitalization. This happened fairly recently. But this condition is something that can occur in the context of influenza, chickenpox, herpes, so other viral infections. And it happens very rarely in those. So it could be a very rare symptom of or complication of COVID-19. So this case study, and there's another case study that reflects a similar trend, I just want to highlight because given that COVID-19 affects such a wide population of people, there may be a certain not insignificant percentage that develop symptoms like this. So that's something for both doctors to look out for, of course. But if you yourself or a loved one begin developing these signs, that could be a clue to a potential COVID-19 infection, given that it's so prevalent in the population right now. But these are early days of those studies, so we'll learn more in the coming weeks. For those of you just joining us, again, my name is Nicoletta Lanise, and I'm a health reporter here at Live Science. I'm getting near wrapping up my updates for the week, and then I'm going to open up the floor to your questions. So if you do have any throughout the live stream, please put them in the comments below, and I'll try to get to as many as possible. Kind of connected with trying to understand why we're seeing people across demographics succumb to this illness in the way that they do. So we're seeing young and historically healthy people developing serious complications and dying from this illness. So there's a big question as to why is that happening. So there are many genetic studies underway looking to pool data from all over the world and look at the genomes of people with mild asymptomatic cases and compare them to those who develop very severe illness from COVID-19 and seeing if there's some sort of through line as to why some people seem more susceptible to the serious illness. There's an idea that perhaps there's a difference in the gene that codes for the receptor that COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2, which the virus that causes COVID-19, prefers to infect in human cells. So that's called the ACE2 receptor. So there might be a difference in how people's genes code for that receptor and build that receptor. There may also be just an inherent difference in immune response, which you can look at more closely by looking at people's genetics. And there was one case study in China that suggested that people of certain blood types may have some sort of protective traits that help them stave off the worst of the illness. That's very preliminary, but people are looking further into that to see if there's some sort of connection between the blood type and enhanced vulnerability to this virus. So those are all underway. And just to give you an update on, we've heard a lot about aerosols, which are very, very small particles, smaller than respiratory droplets, that can also contain viral particles and transmit diseases between people. So a couple of weeks ago, there was a preprint study, meaning it was not yet peer-reviewed, that came out that suggested that in lab tests, it seems like the virus can remain in the air as an aerosol for up to 3 hours and be viable, meaning that if you sample the virus from those aerosols, you can grow it in a lab dish. So that would suggest it could infect people. Some caveats to the study are that this was, again, performed in a lab, so they were using specialized equipment to create these aerosols, which, of course, in a standard setting, so like in an everyday setting, you wouldn't have a specialized instrument to create the aerosols. So at first, there was some question as to whether this would be important at all in everyday settings. It definitely is important in healthcare settings where people are intubated, meaning that a tube is inserted into their windpipe to help them breathe, or they use nebulizers, which turn medications into an inhalable mist. Aerosols are, in essence, a mist-like substance. So if you think of, say, the aerosols you spray out of a can, you can picture that kind of mist. So that's what we're talking about here. So it's definitely important in healthcare settings, remains very important in healthcare settings. But now there's been some scattered evidence of it. These aerosols being generated in everyday environments. So for instance, there was a count of a choir group who met for rehearsal and did maintain a decent distance away from each other, but still about 50 or so members tested positive for COVID-19 following that rehearsal, and two died from the disease. So there's some idea that, especially in enclosed, poorly ventilated spaces, aerosols could be important even in everyday settings. We're still learning how much virus needs to be present in those aerosols to actually infect a person. So that's a huge question. And generally speaking, experts think that in outdoor spaces where aerosols would disperse more widely, they shouldn't be much of a concern. So it's really more enclosed, poorly ventilated spaces, as far as we know now, that aerosols are a real problem. So just something to keep in mind and to look out for in the coming weeks. We should learn even more about how aerosols factor into transmission. Okay, since we're about halfway through the live stream now, I'm going to open up the floor to your questions. I'm seeing that we have a good number this week. I'm getting a question. Any idea yet if you become immune to the novel coronavirus once you've had it and recovered from it? So there is evidence that people, number one, develop an antibody response fairly early in illness against the coronavirus, meaning that their immune system develops antibodies that learn to recognize and latch onto different proteins on the virus's surface, and these help to target the virus for destruction in the body. And in this way, the immune system learns to spot the virus if you were to ever encounter it again. So it seems like that is happening, number one, within COVID-19 patients. But there was also a small study in rhesus macaques, which are a type of monkey, that attempted to reinfect the monkeys with COVID-19 after they contracted the illness once. So they inoculated 4 rhesus macaques with SARS-CoV-2. They developed an illness very similar to humans. And then they attempted to reintroduce that virus back into the monkeys after they had fully recovered from that initial illness. And it appeared that they could not catch COVID-19 again. That was a really short study. So basically, the monkeys were reintroduced to the virus immediately after recovery. So again, that's a very small window of time. So we don't yet know how long immunity lasts in humans. So that remains a huge question. But at least in the short term, all evidence so far points to the idea that people also develop immunity against the virus. Now, that could change if the virus were to dramatically mutate. I'm actually getting a question about mutation. Someone's just asking, will the virus mutate? In general, all viruses are mutable and mutate at least slightly on a fairly continual basis. What we know about this virus so far is that it seems to be mutating fairly slowly, which is great news for vaccine and treatment development, given that vaccines work to take characteristic bits of the virus and train the immune system to recognize those bits, either by using a dead or weak version of the virus and introducing that into the body, or you can prompt human cells to build those proteins on their own by introducing genetic material into the body instead. So that's how some of these early vaccines are actually built. So yes, the virus is actively mutating, as viruses do, but it seems like it's mutating slowly enough that our attempts to generate treatments and vaccines should be effective once those preventative measures are widespread and available. I'm getting some questions about symptoms either in you yourself as an individual or in a family member or a friend, and wondering when you should go to a doctor, whether you should try to get tested, all that sort of thing. So I'm quickly going to run through the symptoms that we know about that are associated with the virus in general, and then I'll give you an idea of what you should do if you think you're developing these symptoms. So generally speaking, the major symptoms that we hear about constantly connected with this virus are a fever. So it could be a mild fever all the way up to a very severe fever, a dry cough, meaning you're not feeling phlegm build up in your lungs, at least early in the illness, or in your upper respiratory tract, rather. So that's what I mean by dry cough. And then some people are developing fairly severe digestive symptoms as well. So a good proportion of people seem to develop diarrhea, nausea, vomiting. So things like that could be associated. There's some idea that the virus might even target cells within the gastrointestinal tract, but that is really early days research, so they're still looking into that deeply. But some people are actually showing mostly digestive symptoms, so that's something to look out for. Again, like I said, rarely you're seeing these instances of an altered mental state, so connected with that enhanced immune response that's breaking down blood vessels in the brain or the tissue that separates the blood vessels from the rest of the brain tissue. So that's a very rare symptom, at least as far as we know. And we're also seeing at least fairly anecdotally at this point, that some people are experiencing a loss of sense of a loss of smell and taste early on in the disease. So people are looking into that actively and trying to survey larger proportions of people to determine if that is truly a very common symptom or just a kind of a symptom that we're hearing a lot about now but isn't actually prevalent in most of the population. But if you lose your sense of smell or taste, that could also be an early sign, but we don't know enough about, number one, why that would be happening, or number two, if it truly is a common symptom. And it's also associated with many other respiratory illnesses. So it might not be incredibly unique to COVID-19. And given that we're moving into allergy season, at least here in the U.S., people could be developing colds. There's other reasons you lose your sense of smell. So take that with a grain of salt. Given all that, so there's your symptom context. If you develop milder symptoms and you are not in a high-risk category, the advice that people have been given is to self-quarantine at home. If, for instance, you need to go out grocery shopping and you live with other people, perhaps have them go out to the store to minimize your risk of spreading, if you do have COVID-19, spreading it to other people. If you must go out, try to cover your mouth with something. Obviously, we're seeing that a lot of proper surgical masks, et cetera, and N95s are sold out or hard to find. So even if you can just cover your mouth with a homemade mask or a scarf is better than absolutely nothing. If you are in a high-risk category, again, if you're nervous at all, I would suggest that you speak to a medical professional. So if you can reach out to a doctor, that's usually the best way to go. I myself am not a doctor, so I cannot give you registered medical advice. But generally speaking, because diagnostic testing is still limited, it's depending on where you live and what resources are around you. It may be that you're simply advised to stay home until you start developing severe symptoms, like perhaps a very severe fever, so a high fever. If you develop shortness of breath and find yourself struggling to breathe, that's definitely a sign that you should head to the hospital. Simply because that is a sign that the illness has progressed fairly significantly and is affecting your lung tissue. And home remedies and treatments that you give to yourself when you have a mild illness probably won't help you to recover that shortness of breath. So I would say definitely that's a sign to head to the hospital and at least call a doctor. So again, there's that range of symptoms. But if you start developing any of the mild ones, just keep tabs on yourself day to day, I would say, and try to track those symptoms through time. And if you're experiencing serious discomfort in that you can't breathe or your fever has run out of control and nothing's helping, that would probably be a sign to head to the hospital at least. I'm going to question about other types of coronaviruses. So generally speaking, there are four very common coronaviruses that infect humans and actually use humans as their primary hosts. So these four have very strange names that are just collections of letters and numbers, but they, generally speaking, cause symptoms of the common cold, so they're fairly mild and just in line with other viruses that also cause the common cold. Then you also have coronaviruses that jumped from animals into people. These include the SARS virus, the MERS virus, and now SARS-CoV-2. The coronaviruses that jumped from animals into people do share a variety of similarities in that in people, so they all seem to have originated in bats, number one. Bats act as reservoirs for many different types of diseases, and there's a few theories as to why that is. Most theories point to the idea that the bat's immune system does not react very violently to bits of viral genetic material floating around in the animal. And this is because when bats are in mid-flight and they're expending a lot of energy, their genetic material can actually become damaged and bits break off. So these bits of genetic material are pretty much always floating around in bats. So the animals don't react super strongly to incoming viruses and don't contract severe illnesses like we see in humans. So once a virus that's born in bats and doesn't bother bats mutates, jumps into a different animal, jumps into humans. The goal, quote unquote, not to say that viruses have goals, but how that virus operates, its mode of operation differs a bit. So the thought is that within the bats and animals, that don't contract severe illnesses, that the virus might be successful in spreading and replicating well and multiplying within the body. Whereas once it jumps to humans, it generates this intense immune response and actually kills off its host, which in the long run isn't great for viruses, because if you can spread between hosts without actually killing them off, you can replicate more indefinitely if you think about it. So that's part of the difference evolutionarily. So all of the coronaviruses that hopped from animals to humans kind of have this trend of not generating an immune response in bats and then having these kind of upper respiratory to deep respiratory symptoms in humans. They differ in terms of the mortality rates, in terms of how transmissible they are. It seems like SARS-CoV-2, given that there's so many people with asymptomatic to mild cases, is particularly dangerous in that it transmits in a way that's very difficult to track. Whereas with the SARS virus, it seemed like people were most contagious later on in disease once the virus had descended and infected their lung tissue, which results in a more severe illness. So if you're thinking about it, if people present to the hospital with a more severe illness and they're diagnosed and they're taken care of and then they're sent home, there's less chance of those people moving about in the world and transmitting to other people because they're sick at home or in the hospital. Whereas with this virus, people can be carriers and not feeling symptoms themselves, but they truly are infected and then pass it on to others. So that's part of what sets this virus apart, is that it's the way it presents in people is hard to track. I'm getting a question about social distancing best practices. So this question says, I'm noticing people will observe social distancing with inside, but when outside, when they're walking past you, they're not observing it, as though fresh air makes a difference. Should people still social distance while in outdoor spaces? So I've noticed the opposite trend, so that's really interesting. But generally speaking, social distancing between people who are not members of the same household should be practiced at all times. So if you are in an indoor space with people who are not members of your household, say you're at a store, generally 6 feet of distance between you is considered the bare minimum of what you should have between people. There is some question as to whether 6 feet is far enough, because respiratory droplets, say if someone has a really hearty cough, so really strong cough, and they don't cover it at all, and it's directed right at you, it's not like there's an invisible wall at 6 feet where that respiratory droplet hits and falls to the floor. There is a possibility that it can travel beyond that point. So 6 feet is just a rule of thumb measurement. And also, if you're bad at estimating 6 feet of distance, like I am, you can think about it as compared to your arm span. So for instance, I'm about 5'7", so my arm span is roughly 5'7". So if I think about being at least 2 arms length plus a bit from another person, that's how far I have to be. But you can compare that for yourself. And some grocery stores are being nice and putting markers on the floor for where you should stand in line, all that sort of thing is great. Now in outdoor spaces, there is a thought that because, number one, if you're passing someone actively, there's simply statistically less of a chance that a particle would hit you on the way, if you think of that drive-by kind of scenario. And also in the open air, the particles can disperse more readily and become swept up by wind, all that sort of thing. So truly, the environmental factors do make a difference here. To be in an enclosed, poorly ventilated space is much more places you at a higher risk of transmission, I'll say. Now that said, we are not positive of the role of aerosols in different everyday environments as of yet. Generally speaking, best practice overall is to stay at home with only the members of your own household as much as possible and limit exposure to anyone else. And the exact amount of distance from someone is mostly important if you're spending an extended period of time near them. So if you're passing, obviously the longer you stand next to a person, say you're talking with your neighbors in your driveway, the longer you spend, even if you're standing a decent length away from them, the higher your risk of transmission is going to be. So think about that as well. So if you're taking a quick walk around your block, that's a fairly low risk scenario in this context, as far as we know, as compared to standing and chatting with someone from not that far away. So just keep all these things in mind. And again, to reiterate, 6 feet is truly a rule of thumb kind of measurement. And if you want to be super duper safe, 10 feet might be a better measure if you think about that. Or, you know, if you could stand a full street away from someone, obviously that's even safer. The farther you are, the safer. I'm getting a question as to whether a recovered person can still be a viral vector. So are they still contagious after recovering? So there is evidence that even people who have technically recovered from the illness itself and are not presenting symptoms anymore can carry a fair amount of the virus in their systems for about 2 weeks afterwards. And this is in people with mild infections. So a fair number of people contract mild infections, so that covers a lot of people. But for those with more serious infections, it could be a longer length of time since their viral load was higher to begin with. So yes, there is some chance that even recovered people could theoretically carry some contagiousness still. But there is evidence to suggest that people with COVID-19 are at their most infectious at the start of illness, actually. So a small study, a preprint that came out a few weeks ago, suggested that within the first 1 to 5 days of illness is when you see people's viral loads peak, at least those with mild infections, and that they shed the most virus. So shedding viruses is spewing viral particles everywhere, in essence. So it's early on when symptoms begin to emerge, or in some people when they are still even asymptomatic, they can be spreading it. So it's, at least in mild infections, that seems to be the case. And then it seems like those viral loads peak and begin to shed later in those with the more severe illnesses. But it's still fairly early on, so within, say, a week to 2 weeks of illness. So those who have recovered, presumably their viral loads have dropped significantly, so they're far less likely to be contagious. But we're still learning more about that day to day, especially now that we have more cases that we know about to study. We're getting close to the end of our live stream here, so I'm going to pick one more question to answer. Thank you all for submitting so many this week. And if you do have follow-up questions, many of these have already been answered on LifeScience.com in full-fledged articles that you can read and learn more about the virus and where we're at in understanding how it works. We also have multiple longer articles. I didn't talk a ton about treatments this week and the vaccines, but we have many articles that list out the treatments in more detail and those that are in clinical trials and those that are showing promise. Those have not shown promise as well. So those that have entered clinical trials and then have not proven very effective, we also mentioned those. So please visit the Life Science site for that. And you could also pose more questions on our forums, forums.lifescience.com. Or here, even, we'll be monitoring this thread for a bit, and we'll be sharing more articles with you in answer to the questions I couldn't get to today. I'm going to answer this question, which is a difficult one, but I want to address it anyway. There's a question of why are there asymptomatic people in the first place? And the answer is we really don't know yet. There has been a statistic thrown around that was gathered from a recent preprint that came out that suggests as many as 25% of people that contract this illness do not end up developing overt symptoms, which is a very large percentage. And of course, that number will be amended as time goes on and we learn more about truly how many cases we have out there. But it's unclear why some people generate a really strong immune response to this and start developing severe symptoms, and other people seem to not be affected by the virus much at all, but simply serve as a carrier for it to spread to new people. Given that, though, I want to drive home the importance of, again, social distancing. Given that even now not everyone can be guaranteed a diagnostic test, antibody tests, which will test who has been exposed to the virus and maybe has already recovered, are becoming distributed in some select places. So there's one town in Colorado that is testing everyone in this 8,000 person town is receiving an antibody test as funded by a biotech company that's partnering with the town. So we're seeing hotspots like that, and the CDC is working on antibody tests as well. And there's one from the Inken School of Medicine in Mount Sinai that is being validated as we speak. So we're getting closer and closer to antibody tests, which will tell us who has been exposed to the virus. And that will give us a better idea of how many people didn't develop symptoms at all. And then we'll have a better estimate. Once we have that data, we can dig into kind of the genetics and the health histories of those people who don't develop symptoms and determine if there are significant differences between those people and between the people that develop severe complications, particularly those who don't have a history of other illnesses. So it's one thing if you are elderly or if you have a compromised immune system or if your lungs or heart are compromised in some way. But for the healthy people with limited medical history, that's the big question is, why are some people spared from symptoms altogether and why do others develop, say, a near fatal to fatal pneumonia? And all that will become clearer in the coming weeks, and I hope to have a better answer to your question soon. And with that, I think we'll wrap up for this week. Thank you again for tuning in and sharing all your questions. We'll continue to do this as this goes on, and please practice social distancing.
Thanks for joining us for this special coronavirus report from Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. You can find all the Live Science coverage of the coronavirus and COVID-19 on our website at livescience.com/topics/coronavirus.
We'll be refreshing our FAQ and coronavirus updates daily as information becomes available. The link is in the show notes.
If you have questions about coronavirus or COVID-19, you can post them on our Live Science forums and on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us, and stay healthy.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals network.